Drs. Abubakar, Davison, and Miller-Ellis. Thank you for joining me for this podcast to discuss how newer topical and surgical therapies continue to transform the glaucoma treatment landscape. Dr. Abubakar, let's set the stage by reminding the audience of the aqueous humor outflow pathways that are top of mind for ophthalmologists and optometrists as they approach glaucoma management.
There's two important pathways to keep in mind, the conventional aqueous outflow pathway as well as the uveoscleral outflow pathway. So the vast majority of aqueous outflow goes through the conventional outflow pathway of the trabecular meshwork and Schlemm's canal, and then a small amount of the aqueous outflow occurs through uveoscleral outflow, which is the ciliary muscle into the supraciliary space. And there are treatments available for glaucoma that target each of these pathways and increase outflow through them.
Thank you, Dr. Abubakar, for that concise overview. Dr. Davison, how do you approach selecting initial topical therapy for a patient with glaucoma?
So when I approach my initial topical therapy, of course, I want something that's going to be effective, very easy for the patient to do. So I'm looking at topical medication that's going to be once a day. Know that it's going to have that effectiveness to get to that target pressure that I want fairly quickly, and ease of cost. All those things are very important for the patient to be able to be compliant. In my practice, they say a lot of your practice patient base kind of follow your age. So most of my practice, my patients that I am diagnosing with either glaucoma or ocular hypertension, and we're doing intervention versus via topical, they're young. So I want something that's not going to disrupt their life. So I still typically go towards a topical prostaglandin analog, still one of my first line of choices that I use. One, because it hits all those points, it's very convenient, easy to do. There are multiple options to be able to choose from. So therefore, I usually can find one that's going to be very cost effective for my patient. And it's going to hit that target pressure. We know that they are effective. On average, they lower the IOP anywhere from 4 to 5 millimeters. And so I look at cost, ease, as well as the age of my patient, how long they've been doing this therapy. And I want something that's going to hit all those points.
And following along with that question, what are potential adverse events observed with use of the traditional topical therapies?
So yes, definitely. I'll start with one that I pick usually top line is prostaglandin analogs. The complications are adverse events are low, but we do want to talk to our patients about iris pigmentation changes, changes in pigmentation around the skin of the periorbital tissue, periorbital fat changes, as well as retinas. You definitely want to educate your patient on retinas. And then some other adverse events are lengthening of lashes. And some people may think that as a plus or a minus, but some that are a little bit more serious are beta blockers. You definitely want to make sure when you're prescribing a beta blocker, which are effective and can be convenient as well. Sometimes you take them just once to twice a day, but you do really need to ask your patients about their overall heart health and if they have any pulmonary issues. In the past, I've had patients who were transferred for care to me or self-referrals who were on those medications, and those questions weren't asked about their overall health, specifically pulmonary issues or heart issues, and the patient was experiencing some complications due to that medication. And then some of the topical medications do have adverse events where there's a lot of stinging, irritation on the front surface of the eye that can cause compliance issues. But the two major ones I think we use a lot still are our prostaglandin analogs. We use a lot of our beta blockers, particularly the beta blockers. You have to be very careful with those and ask those specific systemic questions of your patients.
Dr. Miller-Ellis, share with us your approach to progressing therapy in a patient with glaucoma.
In terms of how to progress a patient with topical glaucoma medication, we all typically start with a prostaglandin, but if the prostaglandin is ineffective or not tolerated, there are other classes of medications that can be used. Typically, there's a beta blocker, which usually is timolol. There are carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, of which there is a dorzolamide and brinzolamide. And then there's also alpha agonist, which would be brimonidine. Most of the time, as long as there is no medical reason to not use it, I go with timolol, which is a beta blocker. You know, they've been used, they were first line before prostaglandins. They've been used for many decades for glaucoma and are quite effective and can be used once a day. So anything that can be used on a once a day schedule, I think is an advantage for the patient. However, some patients have medical contraindications to using a beta blocker, such as having asthma or any type of pulmonary disease, because it can induce wheezing or shortness of breath. Or some patients that have a slow heartbeat, because beta blockers can also slow the heartbeat down. After the beta blocker, I typically go to a topical carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, and that would be dorzolamide or brinzolamide. And I typically go there because many people are responsive to it. You know, sometimes particularly dorzolamide can sting on instillation, but if the patients can tolerate a little bit of stinging, and just as an aside, brinzolamide, which is a suspension as opposed to a solution, stings less because the pH is different compared to dorzolamide. They're equally effective. And so if you have a patient that has good pressure reduction on dorzolamide, but the stinging really bothers them, I think that brinzolamide is an excellent alternative. And then the allergy rate with that, if you're going to have a problem, you typically have it early on. Brimonidine is another drug that I do use quite often, but it's fairly common to get a delayed allergic reaction to brimonidine, and that would be follicular conjunctivitis or this kind of, you know, periocular dermatitis. And I've had patients who've tolerated brimonidine for months to years, and then they come in with an allergy. So you always have to be aware that that is a medication that characteristically causes a delayed allergy. Another medication that can be quite effective is Notarcidil, which again is a once a day drug. And it is a Rho kinase inhibitor, which can be very effective in terms of lowering intraocular pressure. There can be tolerability issues in some patients, typically some redness and stinging. But if it works for them, it's great to have once a day therapy that can really give them a wide range of pressure reduction. Some people respond sort of mildly, but I've had just some dramatic improvements in IOP with the use of Notarcidil.
Dr. Davison, we have Notarcidil, a ROCK inhibitor, as one of the newer topical agents approved to treat glaucoma. What are your impressions of data supporting Notarcidil efficacy and safety?
So Notarcidil data was interesting data. First, Notarcidil works in kind of a two-mechanism pathway on the trabecular meshwork, as well as on the episcleral venous pressure. But there were two studies, the ROCKET 1 and ROCKET 2. They did show that Notarcidil was not inferior to timolol used just once a day. So that medication is very effective as a once-a-day medication standalone, as well as a combination therapy. One thing you do want to take away that was displayed in those studies is that the redness or amount of hyperemia compared to just a prostaglandin analog was increased about 50%. And then you still also want to pay attention to the anterior structures, particularly the cornea. There was some presentation of cornea verticillata, but studies didn't necessarily show that presentation caused any reduction in the vision. But the big take home from that study is that there were two comparative studies to show that it was not inferior to twice a day timolol, and it could be very effective as a standalone medication as well as a combination medication.
Thank you, Dr. Davison. Now let's visit the topic of adherence to topical drops. We know that this can be challenging, particularly when dosing is multiple times a day. What are tips for how eye care clinicians can help promote patient adherence to topical drops?
Medication adherence is a challenge with glaucoma therapy. You know, patients sometimes have difficulty getting drops in their eyes, just sort of aiming for their eye can be a bit of a problem. And then waiting the requisite amount of time between drops when they're due at the same time, so that you don't dilute the effect of the first drop by putting the second drop in too quickly. A lot of times what I'll do if patients tell me they can't get their drops in and that's a reason for their lack of adherence is I will give them an eye drop lesson in the office, and I will demonstrate to them how to put the drops in, and then I'll have them do it to themselves And that helps them gain confidence. It lets them, or if there's someone with them, like a family member who also instills the drops, then they know what kind of techniques can be helpful. And sometimes something as simple as that can improve compliance. In addition, if someone has difficulty getting their drops in, they may run out of drops before the, 3 to 4 weeks is up where they can get it refilled at the pharmacy. And if they can't get a refill because the bottle ran out too soon because of them missing their eye and trying to put in another one, it actually helps keep from wasting the drops if you do a good eye drop lesson with them. If their issue is more kind of forgetting to take the drops, which again is an easy thing to do, to forget to do something, I always ask them if they're on some other medication, or I basically check their medication list and I can see what other meds they're on. And sometimes if they just pair the administration of the eye drop with when they do their other medications, that can remind them. Particularly with prostaglandins that we often recommend that they take at bedtime, it's a constant problem with people falling asleep at night before they take their drops because they say, oh, it has to be bedtime. I say, it doesn't have to be bedtime. It can be evening, or you can just pick a time that works for you, whether it's with your evening meal or even in the morning. I mean, I think the prostaglandins can work well at any time of day. If they take morning medications, put your eye drops with your pills and take it at that time. I think that the more you can pair the administration of the drops with another activity they're already doing, that it's easier for them to keep up with their schedule. And again, remind them that when drops do at the same time, don't put them in back to back, wait 5 minutes. Some patients actually wait 30 minutes or an hour. And I tell them, you don't have to wait that long because you're more likely to forget if you wait that long. And then you feel like your whole day is monopolized by using eye drops, particularly if you're on 2 or 3 drops and you're doing one at 7 o'clock and one at 8 o'clock and one at 9 o'clock. I mean, just think about how much time that uses up. And if you can consolidate a time for the patients, that helps them adhere as well. So I guess my bottom line would be, make sure they can actually get the drops in their eyes, aim for efficiency, getting everything in as short of a reasonable time period as possible, and to try to pair the use of the eye drops with other medications. And hopefully they take their other medications as they should, otherwise they'll be forgetting them both. The other important thing to remember in terms of medical therapy is to use the least amount of medications as are effective in a given patient. And so you hear the term maximum tolerated medical therapy. For some patients, that might be 1 drop, and for some patients, that might be 4 drops. But what that really means is that every time you start an eye drop, you have to assess what the efficacy and tolerability is. If the patient is, if it doesn't work, then get rid of it. Don't just add something else to what they're already using, because you're adding a medication that maybe could be effective to a medication that's not effective, and they're taking 2 things. And so every time I add a drop, I assess how well it works. If it works well, then I'm happy about that. Or if it works but not well enough, then I'll add another medication. Assessing how well the patient tolerates it at each step along the way. Because if a drop gives a patient, redness or irritation, or it's uncomfortable, they may tell you that they're using it, but they're not really using it. And so definitely try not to add on if you don't think it's really working. Assess side effects at every single step along the way, and use the minimum amount of eye drops that gives you the effect that you're looking for.
Dr. Abubakar, you'd like to comment?
Yeah, so I think that it's important to kind of understand why the patient is non-compliant. Like, is it an issue with difficulty with administering the drops? Is it an issue with forgetting to use the drops? And in terms of administering the drops, it does help when you first initiate a patient on therapy to kind of walk them through how to actually administer the drops. And if they have difficulty doing it themselves, potentially having them purchase an eye drop aid versus help have a family member help them with the drops. In terms of patients who are sometimes forgetting to take their drops, I often tell them to set a timer on their phone to kind of remind them to take it at a certain time. And so that helps with that, in terms of helping them remember to take it at a certain time.
Thank you both. I'm sure our audience appreciates those tips for how to help patients effectively use their topical drops, because we know that the goal is 24/7 IOP control. Given that we have some sustained release options useful for patients, Dr. Abubakar, will you tell us about those?
Yeah, so there are two different implants available currently. There is the Durista implant, which is a sustained release bimatoprost implant, and that can be placed at the slit lamp in clinic. And then there is the iDose, which was just recently approved, which, with that one, the patient will need to go to the operating room to implant that. These are good options in terms of patients who are having difficulty with medication compliance, as well as patients who cannot tolerate drops due to side effects from the medications. Unfortunately, some of these sustained release options do have a small risk of corneal decompensation, and so it's not a good option for patients who have corneal pathology to begin with. And then the other thing is these sustained release options, they work about as well as the drop that they are replacing. And so if a patient needs a much lower target than just that, then that might not be the best option for them. And then it might be good to consider other options such as minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries or traditional glaucoma filtering surgeries.
Thank you, Dr. Abubakar. Dr. Miller-Ellis, let's talk about MIGS, or minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. What types of outcomes does MIGS provide in terms of IOP control?
Okay, so whenever we're operating on a patient that has glaucoma, particularly if we're combining it with cataract surgery, doing a MIGS or microincisional glaucoma surgery is really at the top of our list of what we'd like to do with patients that have mild to moderate glaucoma. Our goal with MIGS is really to try to decrease the patient's dependence on anti-glaucoma medication. And so if they can be eye drop free as far as using their glaucoma meds postoperatively, they're very happy about that. And so I pick really two types of patients for MIGS. One are those who are on, they could be on like one to three different eye drop combinations. And we want to just get them off of at least 50% of them, if we're lucky, all of them. And then there are others that may not have been particularly compliant with their medical regimen preoperatively, and doing the MIGS at the time of cataract surgery is a real opportunity to help them gain intraocular pressure control. Typically, the MIGS result in pressures in the mid-teens. So if you have a patient, for example, where your goal is a very low pressure or closer to 10 or very low teens, the MIGS are not reliable in terms of reaching that pressure goal, but sometimes you might select to do a MIGS on a patient like that on a case-by-case basis, because some patients may respond surprisingly well to a procedure. And if that doesn't work, that standard subconjunctival filtration surgery is an option for them.
What are adverse events and other issues that eye care clinicians should monitor for in patients who have received a MIGS device?
In patients who have had MIGS surgery, there are certain findings or complications that you want to assess the patient for. Everyone who has a MIGS typically has some bleeding, because you are either making an incision in the trabecular meshwork, or you're putting a device through trabecular meshwork that can allow blood to reflux back into the eye and enter the anterior chamber. So it is not unusual to see red blood cells in the anterior chamber on the first post-op day. Occasionally, you might even see a hyphema. I would say less commonly, I see a significant hyphema, and I would describe that as being more than 2 millimeters would be significant. But if I do see that and the patient is not on a blood thinner, I reassure them that with supportive therapy and follow-up, that typically the blood clears, and a lot of times within days, the blood has cleared significantly and their vision improves dramatically. If the patient is on a blood thinner, it's a little bit different story. When I have patients who do need to be anticoagulated, I tend not to do a goniotomy because I, in my experience, that there's a little bit more bleeding with that procedure that can happen not only intraoperatively, but be delayed and occur more postoperatively. That the MIGS devices, and those would be the iStent or the Hydrus, I tend to use in these patients because I don't really see that much delayed bleeding in them. I may see some at the time of surgery, a little bit on post-op day, you know, 1 to 7, but not a significant amount. In terms of what we're looking for later on, of course, we're looking for intraocular pressure control. So that is the main thing that we're assessing. The patients are also on topical steroids as part of their standard postoperative course to help them heal from both their cataract and their glaucoma surgery. And so you have to also assess whether the steroid itself, which is helping with post-op inflammation, might actually be causing the pressure to increase. And you may need to either put them back on some of their post-operative eye drops, some of their preoperative glaucoma eye drops after the surgery, and then maybe after the steroid taper is completed, then you can try to taper them off their glaucoma drops. Some surgeons leave their patients on whatever glaucoma drops they were on preoperatively, and then once the steroid is tapered, then they get rid of the glaucoma drops later. I think that either is acceptable, but the most important thing is that we're following patients for inflammation, for their intraocular pressure, and of course, if there is significant inflammation, you want to, you know, you want to always make sure with gonioscopy that any MIGS device is at a proper location and not causing the patient some type of complication from placement that was suboptimal.
Dr. Davison, we know that optometrists are instrumental in providing care to patients with glaucoma, including those who are great candidates for MIGS. What is your approach to educating and referring for evaluation for a MIGS procedure?
So I have a very good relationship with my referring glaucoma specialist, who is also a cataract specialist. I always kind of say you should set the foundations to see what the expectations are of each one of you playing in this co-management role. But my job, I feel like, is to manage the patient as best as I can. If there are more advanced cases, make sure the patient is aware that the options are available to them. I spend a lot of time educating patients. A lot of patients like to be involved in their clinical care, have some autonomy. So I make sure I tell them that the options are available. I will kind of indicate where I think that they will be a good candidate for sustained release. Or a lot of my patients who are glaucoma patients who are in need of cataract surgery, the benefits of having a cataract extraction and a MIGS procedure at the same time, especially if my patients are taking just one drop, that's going to possibly minimize their need to have to take a drop. Or if they're taking two drops, get them down to one. So I think my role and a role a lot of optometrists are co-managing is very taking the time to educate the patient on what to expect, where they kind of fall in line with the different various advanced therapies that are available, whether sustained release or MIGS. So that takes away some of that chair time that your surgeon doesn't have to spend educating the patient. I like when my patients go and they are already aware of the options that are available. We may have to discuss one that I may be thinking that the patient may lean towards would be a good option, but I still always leave it up to my surgeon to make that final decision with the patient. But my surgeon really values the fact that my patient is coming in educated, and that helps them to have the confidence that they're really involved in their overall outcome. Both of our goals is to maintain the patient's sight as best as we can, effectively as we can, and as convenient as possible for our patients.
Thank you all for sharing your insights on this podcast.